Welcome to this online meeting of the Anarchist Communist Group on the creep of authoritarianism in UK society. We've got three speakers up. The first one is Rob from the Anarchist Communist Group, who will be talking for about 15 minutes. Before we go on, just say that we're going to have questions and answers at the end after the three speakers, if that's all right with everyone. Okay, over to you, Rob.
So the very nature of capitalism and the state is authority. Acceptance and respect for authority is a necessary part of the whole capitalist racket, which is based on the legally enshrined practice of workers selling their labour to the bosses, who in turn live off the profits generated by that very labour. The practice of wholesale exploitation and theft is the very basis of this society, and to run a society such as this requires obedience to the authority of the boss, the entrepreneur, the rich, the powerful, politicians, pundits, celebrities, religious leaders, community leaders, school leaders, the head of the household, military officers, and any of our so-called superiors and order givers in society. Take a breath, that was a bit of a list, that, wasn't it? Okay. Now, while dictatorships generally employ the iron fist and the direct threat of violence, imprisonment, disappearance, murder, and military control to enforce such obedience to capitalism and state, here in more liberal capitalist regimes or so-called democratic capitalism, the ruling class has generally favoured the idea of obedience by consent. Yeah, I know sometimes people say things like, we're living in a dictatorship and this is just fascism. But we're not really in a dictatorship and it's not fascism, though agreed for some, it may often feel like that. And there is a difference, however, between life at most extreme in, say, Nazi Germany and Stalin's Russia, or more up-to-date, Saudi Arabia, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, newly overrun by the misnamed Chinese Communist Party, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and other places. There's a difference between that and life under liberal or supposedly democratic capitalist regimes like we have here in the UK. And that's because, as I said, these systems rely heavily on power and authority by consent. Okay, that's the key thing here. It's the velvet glove approach, though sometimes that glove comes off and we're faced with the iron fist of capitalism and the state. Okay, so however nice it is, however good it is, however fair it is, that iron fist is always there in the background. Now, under the Johnson regime we're living under now, we're living in a period in which that velvet glove is coming off more and more frequently, and we're increasingly being threatened with that iron fist. Increasing authoritarianism, moving in the direction of dictatorship, fascism, totalitarianism, and such like, tends to be employed by the ruling class when it's under threat. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. The level of class consciousness and an organised working class is relatively low. Johnson was elected on a wave of media-constructed popularity. The government has a massive parliamentary majority with a tame parliamentary opposition. So in that way, yeah, I know we've seen the news today and we know what's all bubbling up again, but this is a continuous backdrop, isn't it? And so what we've got, though, yes, there are weaknesses there, but I think we also need to think about the style of government. And they are, however, they're arrogant, vain, dishonest. Yes, I know that's practically the definition of every politician. At times sly, at other times stupid, and are often inept, or at least that's the appearance. They were also elected on a wave of right-wing populism, carefully encouraged and cultivated in the popular press and the mainstream media. Then came the COVID pandemic. It didn't just knock the people of the world for six, it also caused problems and inconveniences for Johnson's government. Lockdowns and no fun were not how things were supposed to pan out. That said, the difficulties with our ability to safely organise on the streets has also been a help to the government ushering in this range of new bills that they've got. And they took full advantage of the restrictions, just like they took advantage by making a load of money for them and their mates with the PPE contracts. It's all about taking the advantage. However, the numerous scandals around sleaze and corruption, there's one on the news today, there'll probably be another one next week. Boris Johnson's countless provable lies, not to mention the thousands of unnecessary COVID deaths, while lowering the government's ratings in opinion poll, is unlikely to affect the future of continued Tory rule. It might affect Johnson, but there's not really much of a challenge to Tory rule. Let's face it, there are other slippery characters to take Johnson's place who will be flattered, puffed up and fully inflated by the right-wing mass media just in time for the next election. Maybe the government's arrogance, vanity, dishonesty and ineptitude are part of the reason for this authoritarian trend, as well as being able to take full advantage of their massive parliamentary majority and a minimal parliamentary opposition. And then there's the fact that class consciousness is relatively low, while patriotic and anti-woke guff is currently quite popular. It's fairly popular in some circles. I don't suppose any of us mix in those circles, but there you go. In other words, they're becoming increasingly more authoritarian because they can. Now, looking at the populist rhetoric, this was originally a populism for Boris Johnson's government on getting Brexit done, taking control of our borders and the usual Tory shite, which has all now festered into a massive anti-woke crusade against anyone who wants people to be nice to each other, act in a socially aware manner, and have some sense of fairness. And it's also virulently against anyone that questions the government narrative. There's a range of authoritarian bills that the government is pushing through, all kind of fitting pretty well with this. Now, the Black Lives Matter protests, footballers taking the knee, the heroic topplers of the Colson statue in Bristol, people like Extinction Rebellion, Insulate Britain, anyone going on strike, participating in a demonstration, or even the most non-violent type of direct action are seen as a challenge to the Johnson clique's authority and all need stamping out. Which all brings us back to the inept bit. After all, capitalism does well for itself when the bosses allow a few pressure valves. Cut that off and things get a bit more dicey. Anyway, that aside, let's have a quick look at these bills. Okay, the first one I'm going to mention is the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill. And the ACG's spoken quite a bit about this on our website and in our publications. Members have been involved in the Kill the Bill campaign and demonstrations and things like that. So I'm not going to go on too much about it. But in short, it criminalises protest. Unless that protest is given prior permission from the authorities, isn't seen by anyone, isn't heard by anyone, doesn't disturb anyone, and has zero effect. Otherwise, you know, if it's like that, you're okay. But otherwise, verboten. It also allows increased police powers of stop and search, brings heavy restrictions into the lives of Gypsy Roma traveller people. So it's heavy on the racism. Now, the bill was shelved for a bit, and now how people cheered at the time. And then it came back with even more draconian measures thrown into the mix. And these include criminalising locking on. If you don't know what locking on is, it's when a person attaches themselves to another person or an object. Now, that's punishable by up to 51 months in NIC. Being equipped to lock on, so not actually doing the locking on, but having the means to do it, that can send you off to chokey as well. They've also brought in this idea of serious disruption prevention orders, or SDPOs, and protest banning orders. These are ASBO-style orders that prevent you from attending certain events, protests, demos, and it even stops you from associating with others with similar opinions. So it's actually stopping, it's a freedom of association thing. You can't even associate with people who have similar political ideas to you. Okay, this is what they're bringing in. So this is how authoritarian it gets. Now, when the bill was initially launched, there was a vibrant campaign that started up to oppose it with hundreds of demos across the country. You probably all know about this. But delays and the government cannily shelving it, then bringing it back, plus the impact of COVID, etc., have all meant that the campaign has lost some momentum. That said, there are demos happening this coming Saturday. Try and get down to one of them. I think we've mentioned some of them on our website. We've got a bit of information on there, but there's plenty of other places on the internet where you can find out all about them. Currently, though, it's relying on the House of Lords. the House of Lords, to try and water it down and make it a bit less draconian. Who'd have thought it ever come to when Lord and Lady Muck were our saviours to stop this authoritarian thing going through? Okay, they won't. They might try and water it down a bit. Then you've got the Nationality and Borders Bill. And this is one of the government's more overtly racist attacks, which allows them to strip up to 6 million people of their citizenship if the government sees them as a potential threat to the interests of the United Kingdom. It targets those born overseas and those with dual nationality. Now, what sort of threat to UK interests is it talking about? Well, nobody knows. It's all a bit vague, which is exactly how the government likes it, as it gives them more leeway to apply it as they like. They're not really defined any of this, right? So in other words, you incur the wrath of the government and that's it. You lose your citizenship, get the fuck out of the country, okay? Consequently, the impact on many black and brown people or those born in another country could well be devastating if they're seen to step out of line. You don't have to step out of line. You just need to be perceived to be stepping out of line. Any sort of illegality, and it doesn't really define that. What is it? A traffic illegality, you know, could get you kicked out. Anyway, there's several No Borders campaigns which are trying to fight this bill. I believe the Manchester one's quite active. I think there's one in Bristol as well. We've also got the Human Rights Bill. This Human Rights Bill attempts to overhaul the Human Rights Act, and it uses the excuses of, it's the usual excuses of common sense and foreign criminals. There's always an excuse though. And this bill aims to remove rights to privacy and family life as well. It also removes the obligations of public bodies to protect the rights of whoever these public bodies deal with. Okay, so I mean, that rights to privacy is to do with spying, okay? And basically the ability of the state to watch people, okay? If they suspect you of anything that they don't like you doing. You know, yes, we might be talking about major terrorists who are planning a bomb somewhere, you know, but we might be talking about something else. None of it's particularly that clear, okay? As is their usual shtick. And it removes the obligations of public bodies to protect the rights of whoever those public bodies deal with, okay? These public bodies, they could be government bodies, for example, okay? Oh, and it aims to protect free speech as well. I think we can all guess which type of free speech it will be protecting. Not ours. Most people who've got anything decent to say, but far right free speech, people like what's his face, Lawrence Fox and other characters like that, you know, they'll do well out of it, I'm sure. There's also the Judicial Review and Courts Bill. It's an interesting one, could be the icing on the cake. Now, if you're not that legally minded, judicial review is a mechanism that allows anyone to legally challenge public bodies, government bodies included, and to question the lawfulness of those public bodies' actions. The Judicial Review and Courts Bill seeks to undermine the ability to challenge anything. Okay, so this will make it more difficult for all those campaigning organisations, for example, Liberty, the Good Law Project and many others to do exactly the kind of thing that it is they do. So I say it's the icing on the cake, but because all these things are going through, they will go through. And the last one is the ability to challenge any of this as well, you know, so make of that what you will. What can we do about all this? Well, the main Kill the Bill type protests at the minute are around police crime sentencing and courts bill and the Nationality and Borders Bill. And it's essential that campaigning against these continues. After all, we're already seeing police forces applying measures from the police crime sentencing and courts bill before it's even been passed into law. We're also seeing heavier sentences for demonstrations, people doing non-violent protests as well, getting a lot of time inside, the whole thing. Realistically, the chances of these bills not going through is virtually nil. But that doesn't mean resistance is futile. What it means is that we'll be having to fight the impact of these bills once they're enacted. This could mean campaigns based on defending those people on the receiving end once these draconian measures are used by the state. And as I say, they're already being used by the state even before the bill has gone through. It could also mean launching a general right to protest campaign. This could be as broad as you like, but something that people can tap into. What it'll come down to is more solidarity, more mutual aid, and more resistance. The government and the police can be resisted, as they did in Pollock Shields not so long ago. Some of you will remember this. But it'll mean large-scale coordinated action, both social and political. That said, we in the ACG don't have all the ideas, don't have all the answers, and we're hoping to hear some of your suggestions tonight. That's what would be good, if we can hear any suggestions in the ongoing discussion. Meanwhile, this Saturday we'll be seeing demos in London, Manchester, Bristol, and in other towns around the country. So get involved. Let's build the resistance, and that'll do from me.
Thanks very much for that lightning whirlwind tour of all the smorgasbord, as it were, of repressive laws that are lining up. We're going over now to our guest speaker, Paul. Perhaps you'd like to introduce yourself, Paul.
Right. Well, thank you for inviting me. You asked me to talk about undercover police in protest and political groups, the issue that's been bubbling along now for quite a few years, since it first broke a long time ago now, over a decade. So this is what I'm going to talk about and just give an overview, maybe just try and tie it in a little bit to obviously the general thrust of the meeting and what it's about. What you've spoken about so far has merely been what you'd call overt forms of repression. There's also covert forms too, and there's also a point at which overt and covert sort of intersect at times, and that's probably where, somewhere along that line, spy cops are located. I mean, obviously they are covert in the sense that they hide away their true nature, but they also can do a lot of damage and have done at times to protest and political activism. What are spy cops, in case anyone doesn't know? Probably most of you do, or have come heard of it, or you might have. But I'd also just want to talk about the origin of spy cops, which goes back a long, long way before this meeting. Obviously, you're talking about what the current government's doing or the Tory party under Boris Johnson, which is like the last 2 or 3 years. Spy cops go way back, like to the 1960s. But before talking about that, I just want to start by talking about a piece of legislation that a lot of you have probably have heard of, and it might be where you get the term spy cops from. And this is a piece of legislation introduced by the Johnson government, the present government, called the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Act. It's Covert Human Intelligence Sources, or CHIS Act, which was introduced in 2020. And its opponents called it the Spy Cops Bill because, very controversially, it gave undercover agents from the state, whether police infiltrators or informants, immunity from prosecution from even the most serious crimes like murder. And Labour, true to form, decided to abstain on the bill. This is obviously, which is Labour under Keir Starmer. So they abstained as it went through the Commons, and although 20 Labour MPs did vote against it. So the decision to give immunity to covert state agents obviously sends a very clear signal that the government still considers covert operations and it's an important tool in its arsenal of weapons. Obviously, that's nothing new about that. I mean, I said earlier that spy cops go back to the 1960s, but actually states employing spies to spy on people it considers a threat goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, they were pretty rife, I think, in Elizabethan England. So you could say that whenever there is a state, there will always be spying on behalf of that state. But the spies I'm going to talk mainly about, undercover police officers who pose as activists, originated in the 1960s. And it's those that were dubbed spy cops by the people who they targeted when the whole scandal broke about 10 years ago. So in 1968, a secret unit was set up within Special Branch called the Special Demonstration Squad. And it was a brainchild of a senior officer called Conrad Dixon, who allegedly said, "Give me £1 million and 10 men, and I will deal with the problem for you." Ooh. Now, the problem, eh? Can we guess what that was? Well, I don't think it's too hard to guess, is it? The 1960s, the problem was social and political unrest. So it was a time of upheaval, as a lot of young people were revolting against the established order. And a lot of these forces coalesced around the Vietnam War in opposition to it. And it was after the riot outside the American embassy in March 1968 that the Labour government at the time decided to set up the Special Demonstration Squad, the SDS. It was set up as a secret unit within Special Branch. And Special Branch had relied on informants ever since it was formed at the end of the 19th century. It relied on them in pretty much the same way as the police who investigate criminal activity, CID, relied on informants amongst criminal organisations. But they considered the intelligence that they were getting from these informants wasn't reliable enough. So instead, they came up with this idea of sending police officers in undercover, posing as activists to get better intelligence. Yeah. And these weren't posing for just a short period of time. They were going to pose as activists over long periods, yeah. At least in the first instance, a few months, but later on for years and years and years and years. Yeah. And so they adopted false identities, false personas, which at the time were usually based on dead children. And they lived amongst the people that they were spying on. The aim of the SDS was to counter what it saw as public disorder, like the riot at the American embassy. When the next protest occurred at Grosvenor Square in October, and it went off relatively peacefully, it was taken as a vindication of the methods of the SDS because they were able to provide some intelligence about it. Although, if you study it more closely, in reality, it was more by luck than design that it did go off peacefully that way. So it was then a decision made to make the SDS a permanent operation, and it received ongoing funding from the Home Office. All this despite only a few senior police officers and politicians knowing of its existence. So over the next four decades, hundreds upon hundreds of political, probably at least maybe 1,000 political protest organisations were infiltrated or monitored. By monitoring, I mean that they were spied on by, say, people at meetings, but not necessarily actively infiltrated, but hundreds were actively infiltrated. So if you were involved in any left-wing struggle, especially one based in or around London over this period from 1968 onwards to the noughties, there is a high likelihood that you knew or became friends with someone who was a spy cop, because there were at least over this period about 150 of them. There was normally about 10 to 12 actually deployed at any one time, but over the whole course of the SDS's existence, about 150. And as the tentacles of the secret state spread far and wide, the range of groups surveyed just grew dramatically. And you didn't have to be a revolutionary organisation to find yourself in the crosshairs of the state. You know, a group advocating women's rights was reported on, and agents were sent deep undercover into the anti-apartheid movement and black justice campaigns set up by the families of victims of police violence. At least 60 workers, trade unions and political activists were blacklisted as a result of spy cops. And left-wing politicians even, Ken Livingstone, Peter Hayne and Jeremy Corbyn among them, also fell within the remit of the SDS. But of course, most attention was reserved for groups seen as subversive or extremist. The SWP is known to have had over 20 spy corps within its ranks. Anarchist groups were obvious targets. And amongst those infiltrated were the Anarchist Workers Association, Friends of Freedom Press, and Class War. But by contrast, you won't be surprised to learn that the far right received scant attention. Just three groups were monitored during this period, as far as we know, of about 40 years. And as the nature of protest changed in the 1980s and 90s to include animal rights and green environmental issues, so the SDS widened its scope. And that's where I sort of come in, really, because I got involved in activism in the 80s in the anarchist animal rights and environmental movements. And that's where I met Bob Lambert, a spy cop some of you may have heard of. And we became friends. He was very typical of spy cops at that time. He used a van. He had a van. They nearly all of them did, to ferry people around to demos. So you'd all be sitting in the van talking to each other. He'd be listening. He'd take people home so he knew where they lived and things like that. And he lived in a dingy bedsit, which they typically did as well. They spent 5 to 6 days per week in the undercover role and the rest with their families. I met Lambert through London Greenpeace, which is a group best known for the anti-McDonald's campaign that led to the McLibel trial. And Lambert, was a very vocal advocate of unlawful direct action and the Animal Liberation Front. And in 1988, he allegedly fled abroad and went on run from the police. But of course, that was just a cover story for his exit strategy, because typically spy cops ended their deployment after 4 or 5 years. And the most common ways of doing this are either by feigning some form of mental breakdown or using an excuse to travel abroad. And then they would never be heard of them again. So a few did send letters to people abroad, one or two letters, and then that's it. You'd never be heard of. So those of us that knew Lambert thought he'd gone on the run, and he was a bit of a hero amongst us. And that's all we knew. But in fact, Lambert later became head of operations at the Special Demonstration Squad, managing other spies in the animal rights groups I was involved in. And one of them, who used the alias Matt Rayner, we don't know his real name, has been accused of encouraging an activist to purchase a sawn-off shotgun and materials with which to build an incendiary device. And the activist was arrested. The police raided his home one morning and he received a 7-year sentence. And he now says that Rayner encouraged him to do it. So spy cops obviously were no strangers to law breaking. Lambert himself was involved in an ALF cell that placed incendiary devices in stores that sold fur, causing millions of pounds damage. And two activists are appealing their convictions over this. Over 50 protesters had their convictions quashed because of undercover officers and their superiors who concealed vital evidence that could have resulted in their acquittals. One of them is Mark Kennedy, who I'm about to come on to. So for at least 40 years, spy cops went about their operations with complete impunity, but a chain of events led to the unravelling of their long kept secret pretty rapidly, actually, over the course of a year or two. It all fell apart. Much of this was to do with the relationships officers had with activists. It was routine almost from the beginning of the SDS in the 1960s and 70s for male officers to have sexual relationships. And in at least 4 cases, they resulted in children from those relationships. So it was the chance discovery of the passport in the real name of the police spy Mark Kennedy by his girlfriend in 2010 that led to this scandal really being blown open. And Kennedy worked for the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, which was set up in 1999 by Tony Blair's New Labour government. It was larger than the SDS. It had a national remit, whereas the SDS was mainly confined to London and the surrounding counties. And it led to a massive increase in undercover infiltration of groups and campaigns. So while Kennedy was being unmasked in Nottingham in about 2010, further south in London, an activist named Helen Steele, who'd known Bob Lambert and had had an intimate relationship with Lambert's successor in London Greenpeace, a man named John Dines, she found out the truth about them from a female friend who'd also been tricked into a relationship by a man she thought was a fellow activist, but was in reality an undercover officer. So we're going back to about 2010, 2011 now, and Bob Lambert was still on the scene, but he was very much in the public eye because he'd built a career for himself as a so-called radical academic. And this is after he quit the police force, obviously. And he was outed while speaking at a trade union conference in September 2011. And he was filmed running down the road while being pursued by some of those who were spied on in London Greenpeace. So obviously, that's two people now who've been very publicly outed. And the story now was beginning to leak out and go into newspapers. It'd been put in The Guardian, it'd been on Channel 4. And that obviously the police, the Met, now had to try and do something to contain the scandal. And obviously in this time-honoured tradition, it did that by saying it was going to conduct its own internal inquiries and get to the bottom of the truth, you know, the way they always do. The outcome of these inquiries was that these were just the officers were just a few rogue, rotten apples, you know, nothing more serious than that. And then the DPP at the time, who you won't be surprised to learn was Keir Starmer, he said he was oversatisfied. The overturning of convictions of people spied on by Mark Kennedy was not the tip of any sort of iceberg. Something that was, you know, these miscarriages of justice weren't commonplace. So a very much a state damage limitation exercise going on here. This might have worked. It all got scuppered when a former SDS police officer named Peter Francis turned whistleblower and began divulging secrets. On this was to newspapers like The Guardian, and he also appeared on a Channel 4 documentary in 2013. And one of his revelations was that the family of the murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence had been targeted by the SDS. So there was a public outcry. The government could no longer go along and ignore and downplay it and say, oh no, these are just a few rogue officers anymore. Theresa May announced, then Home Secretary announced, there would be a public inquiry into undercover policing. That began in September 2015. This inquiry was supposed to report within 3 years, by 2018, but we're now in 2022 and the evidence hearings have hardly begun. The inquiry is split into a number of stages. Tranche one covers the period from the formation of the SDS in 1968 to 1982. And that didn't begin until 2020 and is going to finish later this year. Tranche two looks at 1983 to 92. And that is now scheduled not to start before May 2024 at the earliest. So the way things are carrying on, it looks like there's every chance the inquiry could last until the end of this decade. And the reason for that mainly has been due to the Met attempting to keep as much of the activities of spy cops hidden as possible. They've applied for restrictions to keep the identities of the officers secret. In response, activists have campaigned for the release of all the cover names of undercover officers in these units. Unfortunately, the chair of the inquiry, John Mitting, has conceded almost everything the Met has asked for. As a result, we do not even know the cover names of many of the spy cops, and some have been granted total anonymity. Close hearings have been heard, in which the victims of police spies, such as known as the core participants for the purposes of the inquiry, was denied access. So we're now in the seventh year of the inquiry, and many of us involved in it feel worn down and disenchanted with the whole process. The resources available to the state, not to mention the bias of the chair, Mitting, means the likelihood of us getting to the truth about these secret units is remote. Obviously, as an anarchist, I'm not that surprised. I was under no illusions about the nature of the state and power. It does not give up its secrets easily. However, there has been a positive side to this. People from all sorts of different campaigns, a diverse range of people and campaigns affected over decades, have banded together, and groups have sprung up like Police Spies Out of Lives, Campaign for Opposing Police Surveillance, and the Undercover Research Group. I started a blog, AR Spy Catcher, which is on Facebook and Twitter. Together, this Spy Cops community has tried to raise public awareness, highlighting the unfairness of the legal procedure and the scandalous behaviour of the spy cops themselves. So, for example, during the inquiry's evidence hearings, the most comprehensive coverage of them has come from daily, weekly updates by COPS, which stands for, as I said, Campaign Opposing Police Surveillance. And these have shone a light on the arcane and at times difficult to follow proceedings of the public inquiry. And then there have been the role of the women who were deceived into intimate relationships with police, who they sued the Met in 2011. And the police did everything they could to obstruct the process and even tried to have their claims thrown out in court. But as the profile of the case grew and the victims were interviewed on TV and the radio, the Met eventually gave in, apologised and paid damages to all the women. Since then, others have taken legal action too. Kate Wilson, one of the women Mike Kennedy deceived into relationship, took her case to the Investigatory Panels Tribunal, which adjudicates on breaches of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. So, and her quest for justice took a decade, and she was vindicated in September 2021 when judges ruled the Met had violated her human rights in no less than five different ways, including inflicting degrading treatment on her. They said a covert operation used to spy on her could not be justified in a democratic society. So I've almost finished. You'll probably be pleased to know. I'll just briefly conclude by just saying what next? Well, the state used undercover policing to stifle dissent and protect the ruling class for half a century. Is there any reason to believe current campaigns and movements that threaten the existing order are not being targeted in the same way? Well, we can be almost certain that they are. We can be certain, in fact, not almost. The SDS closed down in 2008, but we know the National Public Order Intelligence Unit continued operations up until 2011, when it was merged into Counter-Terrorism Command, operated by the Met, which exists to this day. More is done online today than in the past, and there's extensive surveillance of social media. The state no doubt keeps a close eye on groups like Black Lives Matter and Insulate Britain. In October 2011, a covert police unit tried to recruit a Black Lives Matter activist in Swansea as an informant. And this type of infiltration has received less coverage than spy cops, but it is much more common. Police tried to encourage people to grass on their fellow activists by promising to reward them with money or even by blackmailing them. So finally, I'd just like to say one thing is for sure. As long as there is opposition to capitalism and the state, there will be covert and overt surveillance of groups and individuals. We should all be aware of that and be on, you know, looking out for it and take care. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Paul. For that enlightening talk. We're going to go over now to Jenny, who's going to speak on increasing violence against women. Thank you. Over to you.
Right. We're led to believe that there's been a recent epidemic of violence acts against women and girls. The murder of Sarah Everard threw the issue into the public domain, although there have been many other horrific cases and most we don't hear about. Generally, violence against women is treated as a personal tragedy perpetrated by an evil or mad individual. However, it is a structural part of patriarchal capitalism and the UK state. At least 16 women have been killed by serving or former police officers in the UK since 2009. 81 women were killed by men in the 28 weeks following the murder of Sarah Everard, and that was in October 2021 that was spoken about. 62% of women killed by men are killed by a partner or ex-partner. 92% of women killed by men are killed by someone they know. 1 in 12 are killed by their son. It is estimated that there are 139,000 victims of rape every year, and it has to be an estimate because most of them don't report. 1 in 4 women, according to various surveys, have suffered sexual assault. I mean, Paul just spoken about the spy cop situation, but just to say, you know, we live in a state where the state clearly thought it was okay to authorize men to exploit, lie to, and insert themselves into the lives of women, along with everything else they did. At the moment, the police believe they have impunity, and this government will greatly increase this with the legislation that Rob was talking about. The police and judiciary, among other aspects of the state, are designed and structured, among other things, to remove power and autonomy for women. In education, you know, if we're talking about violence against women, it's really important what happens with young people. Young women and girls are increasingly subject to sexual harassment and assault, often at school. The press blame it on social media and throw up their hands in despair. What can we do about that? There's been a government inquiry which came out with some recommendations, this was last year, for schools to deal with it, and an Ofsted report, which has likewise recommended specific actions. In April 2021, following these reports, the NSPCC helpline received 426 calls, 80 of which were serious enough to be referred on to police or social workers. Everyone's Invited is an organisation with a website set up by women to tackle the harassment of girls at school. They've invited girls to provide testimonies about their experiences of harassment at school. They've received 54,046 testimonies from primary and secondary schools and colleges, 2,556 secondary schools and 406 primary. 10% of the schools and colleges in England were named in these testimonies. All of these organisations say that the schools really don't know how to deal with it and often disbelieve the girls reporting incidents. Some just send the victim home. Schools are also under pressure to perform, so they don't want to tarnish their reputation. Many teachers are unaware of what is happening to their students. 90% of the girls spoken to in the government survey said that they didn't report because they had no confidence that anything would result from it and were worried about peer disapproval. If violence against girls is so commonplace, and if boys can torment them so casually, how can we expect them to grow up into caring adults? Education workers, along with parents, need to pay special attention to support girls and boys around their sexual and relationship behaviour and seek out and act upon the sharing of their experiences around the idea of consent, and especially encourage girls to set up and participate in girls' solidarity groups. I'm going to talk a bit about rape, murder and assault and the police. The public discourse around rape is usually in the context of how the police force and judicial procedures can be changed to be more sympathetic to rape victims. Of the estimated 139,000 rapes that take place every year, fewer than 20% are reported and only 1% convict the perpetrator. Only 7% of reported cases are referred to the CPS for trial. On average, it takes more than 2 years for a case to come to trial. So the hurdles to be jumped by any woman wanting to get a conviction are huge, without even thinking about the attitudes of police officers or their trustworthiness. The legal definition of rape is the non-consensual penetration of the vagina, mouth, or anus. Now, that in itself hides a multitude of problems and really narrows, you know, what you can possibly call rape. And rape is about power, or the lack of it, not about sex. The most publicity is given to rape cases where the victim is young, 18 to 24, conventionally attractive, and raped by a stranger. Black women are disproportionately victimized, and all working class women rarely get proper support from the police. I recently spoke to a woman working for a sexual assault referral center, a SARC, about her experiences. Police are able to refer women to the SARC, or women can refer themselves, where they are given forensic examination, offered counselling and support, and can choose whether to pursue a case through the courts. Most don't. She has dealt with cases of women and children ranging from 5 months old to 85 years old, and child cases are quite common. The prevailing view of police officers is that the woman was raped because of something she did or didn't do. The procedure is intimidating and intrusive. She would be asked why she didn't stop him. The main interest of the police is not about proving whether the perpetrator did it, but whether the victim is a credible witness. The attitudes of the police are institutionalized. Experienced officers have been part of a macho, misogynistic group which blames the victim, and newer officers are quickly inducted into this by peers. Frequently, rape victims are given the personal phone number of the officer is dealing with them and told, come straight through to me, don't bother doing this officially, then I'll look after you. Clearly, this is dodgy. After Sarah Everard was murdered, Cressida Dick said that she had a great police force, but Cousins was just one bad un. We know this not to be true, and it's just another instance of the rotten apple scenario which we're presented with so much. What about the 16 officers who have murdered their wives and partners? What about the officers who took selfies to post on WhatsApp in front of the murdered bodies of Nicole Smallman and Bieber Henry? What about all the officers that attacked and arrested women taking part in the vigil for Sarah Everard? So clearly jiggling with police procedures is not going to help. We need to have a different discussion and to move away from treating it as an individual tragedy. Violence against women is about power and oppression, and is an essential part of the patriarchal capitalist system. We need to change the language that we use. For instance, not a woman was raped, but a man raped a woman. What was the perpetrator's behaviour, not what was the woman's? I remember as a shop steward eventually coming to the conclusion that encouraging women to come forward at work and report sexual harassment cases had to be thought about very carefully because of the misery and hatred that would be heaped upon and down upon her. Likewise, when someone rapes a woman, probably reporting it to the police will create more trauma and misery. There are a number of rape crisis centres and other NGOs that can support victims, and community solidarity with women's support groups will be far more effective. I was raped when I was 20 and living in France, and the last thing I wanted was to report him to the authorities. I moved to a different part of the city and relied on friends and comrades to get me through it. That is not to say that rapists should be allowed to walk away with impunity, but that we must deal with them differently. It is all of our responsibility to challenge attacks upon and exploitation of women, just as it is with racism, and to build solidarity and resistance in our communities. As a feminist in the 70s and 80s, we were optimistic about all the changes we fought for towards ending violence against women, with women's refuges, rape crisis centres, reclaim the night activities, sexual harassment at work policies and actions, personal politics and consciousness raising to empower women, community women's groups, support organisations with migrant and immigrant women, women's organisation in trade unions, and so on. Currently, the state is fighting back, as we've heard previously, and women's refuges are closing and desperately seeking funding. Generally, all community organisations or NGOs are being forced to spend enormous amount of time fundraising rather than supporting women, and the police are being given greater powers. I've not gone into all the other aspects of violence against women, as there is not time, but consider there's sexual harassment at work, where one in four women claim to have experienced it. domestic abuse, housing policy, which often forces women to remain in dangerous or abusive situations, women brutalised at work through bullying, low pay, long hours, and being forced to do shifts that necessitate travelling alone at dangerous times and in dangerous places, the treatment of asylum seekers and refugees. All of these things add to the level of fear and vulnerability for women, and are all part of a society that systematically attacks and humiliates women and needs for us to resist it in a systematic way.
Okay, thank you very much, Jenny, for that. We're going to open the meeting to discussion. Oh, yes, and Andrew.
I thought it was really three sort of stimulating contributions, actually. It really made me think. One of the things that stuck for me was these slogans about defending the right to protest. And for me, it's gone beyond that. Protest, to me, means trying to change the attitude of those in power. And we've gone way beyond that. Or calling on government not to legislate. I think it's actually time to rebel, not time to protest. And I think we should be turning the tables on what we've heard about the police. I mean, we should start, we already have been, it's been going on for years. I remember it at Wapping, for example, surveilling the undercover police who were on the marches, on the pickets, getting photos of them and gathering our own intelligence on these things and, you know, blowing it for them. We've got to, you know, it's a defensive operation, but we've got to change our tactics, I think. We're not talking about the right to protest, really. I think we should, you know, we should be taking it full on. It's pretty easy, as we know, to get holes of photos of police from people's social coverage of demos, like the one in Leicester recently. It's quite easy to stop those videos and get stills and zoom in on the police, on the numbers, on the shoulders, on the faces of those cops who are involved and of the plainclothes cops who are behind them. You know, we need to start gathering this intelligence as part of our own defence.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
I remember back in the day that when it was still a Pitchford inquiry, when people were getting bullshitted a lot, and there was a whole conversation among the core participants about pulling out of it. And I have, ever since, I've wondered why they've stayed in it, because to me it just legitimised something that was increasingly a load of bollocks, really. The other thing was, also back in the day, I seem to remember a kind of pamphlet or a leaflet called How to Spot Your Undercover Cop. And I just wondered if anybody remembered that or maybe has a link to that.
Okay, thanks for that. Ah, yes, Tim.
Hi, good evening. So I was like scrolling around on social media today, just looking at some of the chat about the Kill the Bill National Day of Action coming up on this Saturday. And one thing that struck me very strongly was the way or the extent to which the narrative around peaceful protest has become entirely dominant and is being used to rewrite history as if anything that we've ever achieved has been achieved by purely peaceful means. There's a fundamental problem at the moment that people only talk about peaceful protest and nothing but, and that, as we know, will not achieve any change whatsoever. So in Bristol, where we had a decidedly unpeaceful protest or three 9 months ago, and we've got potentially up to 50 people facing individual riot trials over the course of the next 9 months or so, the fact that their crimes are deemed to have not been very peaceful is a serious problem. Most of the left are running away from it. They don't want to know, despite the fact that the police violence was way, way, way worse than any of the violence dished out by protesters on that night. And I should stress that it was more in Bristol, it was more of a party that just got a bit overexcited. It was not a riot in the context, for those of you who remember, say, the riots of the 80s. It was not a serious riot. But the police violence, the response, particularly on the 23rd and 26th of March, was extremely violent and extremely brutal. That is completely ignored, including by our so-called peaceful protesters. And everyone's just running away from the fact. And while people continue to do that, we have a serious political problem on our hands. And I'm not quite sure how we can overcome that, beyond getting people to relearn their history, but it is a fundamental problem that we're facing at the moment.
Thanks, Tim. Rob?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, that there is this narrative that I think the idea is that if it's peaceful protest, that it's okay. I mean, look, I'm not going to fetishise violent protests. Why would I? You know, but the police are violent. The state has a monopoly on violence, and it jealously guards that monopoly on violence, and they'll use it as and when they want to. And if you want to get your head kicked in by the police, then fine. But sometimes you have to fight and you have to resist that. And that seems to me what happened in Bristol. The police are never going to get done for these things because the state has that monopoly on violence as well. It's the fact that people do shy away from that. In my own Kill the Bill group, there were people who were saying like, oh yeah, but there were violent in Bristol, weren't they? And they were put right about this, you know, and we had a discussion about it. I said, well, look, the violence is coming from the police here, you know, and people have a right to defend themselves and have a right to fight against something that is unjust or anything, you know, and it's whatever means are deemed necessary to do this. You know, and people did. It's that a discussion that's worth having because people will understand it when it's explained in that way. You know, but I think it is something that needs addressing. Not that I'm saying that we should all be out starting riots or anything, but that you know, it's an important part. The poll tax was overturned not because, well, it was a two-pronged thing. Partly a mass campaign of people not paying. Refusing to pay in their thousands, or was it millions of people who refused to pay, which caused the system to break down. And the straw that broke the camel's back was the riots that went, it wasn't just Trafalgar Square, there were riots kicking off at all sorts of town halls all around the country. And then there was the big Trafalgar Square one that really, you know, that put paid to it, you know? So it's that combination. Some things work and some things are appropriate and some things are not. You know, it depends on your circumstances. But yeah, people fetishize non-violence and some people fetishize violence as well. So it's got to be what's practical, what's realistic, and also what people are prepared to do. Somebody mentioned earlier about the things, Andrew, you mentioned about turning the tables on people and filming. Was it filming the police? I think it was. That takes me back. I was involved in a claimants union years ago, and they had the snooper squad came in to spy on people. And the claimants union went round and took photographs of all the snoopers and then plastered them up on as long days before the internet, years before the internet, and plastered up massive posters of all these snoopers all over the lampposts and every street in the area where the snoopers were coming in. And they got out of town pretty quick.
Thanks for that. Paul.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick. I just wanted to reply, to something someone said about the public inquiry, about people who are part of it, of pulling out or boycotting. Sorry, I've forgotten your name, whoever mentioned that. And also about a booklet called How to Spot an Undercover Officer. Well, I'll talk about that. Well, firstly, I've never heard of it. I don't know when it appeared or what. I mean, it's the sort of thing I would have taken an interest in probably even before the spy cops thing happened. And I just want to say, you've got to be very careful. We have to be careful of paranoia and of accusing people and of being suspicious of everyone we meet. I mean, we were, I think, a bit too naive in the past. Well, I know I was around infiltration, probably should have paid more attention to the dangers of it. But equally, if you go to the other extreme and start being totally paranoid and doubting everyone and suspecting everyone, you can't really run a group or a movement. The undercover research group has published on its website, and I think also a leaflet called something about 15 things that might ways maybe of spotting if someone might be an undercover officer. They do something like that, a sort of checklist. But they do also advise that you can't always just jump to assumptions about people, even people who don't seem a bit odd or suspicious. And the other thing about the inquiry, I just wanted to say, yeah, I mean, there has been a lot of talk about boycott. I mean, we have boycotted it to the extent that we stopped turning up at the hearings, where people just didn't want to be bothered with it anymore. These were the hearings that happened before the inquiry, public, hearings started, where people gave evidence. These were just where the chair was making rulings and things like that. So those we boycotted. So he just stopped doing it in the court. Yeah, I mean, we do think about, and I've thought about, what's the point of carrying on, but there's always a sort of carrot approach as well, is, well, you don't know what you're going to get out of it in terms of the police handing over any information or files about things they've got, that were kept on people. And some people have received them from the first tranche. Some people I know as well, but they're actually warned not to talk, speak about it with anyone. So I don't know the details, but as the things stand, I think I will carry on being part of it for now and see what happens. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Ben is the next. Thank you.
Yes, sure. I guess a couple of questions. I'm not sure how to word either of them, so I'll give it a go.
Sure.
The first one, on that issue of having that balance between being sufficiently vigilant for all sorts of things, I guess, without going mental and accusing everyone of being a spy, what thoughts are on how you can kind of have cultures where that balance is more or less kept? And the other question, I mean, what I'm kind of most involved with these days, and I guess it is anti-authoritarian, is working with families of people who, have dementia or a learning disability or some other kind of cognitive disability, who are living in long stay segregation. And one of the things, and this is my fault really, is I get quite frustrated that when you meet great people doing this, but also when one tries to get the kind of more overtly anarchisty or radical anti-authoritarian movements, trying to forge links with those, with what I was talking about there about working with families of people in long stay segregation, I can either find there's a lack of interest, but also there are, in the more kind of radical end of politics, you do get a lot of people that actually you don't want anywhere near, an important kind of cause. So I guess the question is it better to kind of keep those two strands of anti-authoritarianism, the kind of stuff that was being talked about today about spy cops, that kind of end of things, and the stuff around disability and institutionalization, keeping those things separate, or is there a way of forming links between the two?
Okay, thanks for that, Ben. Over to you, Rob. You had your hand up.
I can kind of answer your first question. I'm not sure about the second question. And the first one being about how you treat, it was about how you deal with the suspecting people are undercover cops. And
just more generally about, how do you maintain vigilance whilst maintaining your sanity? If activism is going to increasingly mean being surveilled, how do you stay vigilant without going mad and thinking everyone's a spy?
I've experienced undercover cops. One of them has been mentioned on here tonight, and another one who I know has been mentioned in the chat, and the Andy Bryant one that was mentioned. I was in a pub with him, this is years ago, and he was trying to get people to wade into a fight with some youths and stuff like that, and at the time I said he was a dick. I always suspected he might have been a cop. And that, it came out later that he was. But at the time, I think you've got to assume, I think really you need to assume that if you're involved in some kind of politics or organisation, that it doesn't even have to be a revolutionary, it's been said already, it doesn't even have to be a revolutionary organisation. Any kind of organisation that has radical ideas or radical practice or anything like that, that at some point, someone's going to be poking the nose in at some point. If you just assume that that's going to happen, it's not a good policy, I think, to be going around suspecting, that person might be a cop, or that person might be undercover cop, and because that way leads to paranoia, serious paranoia, and also suspecting people who are not. They, as someone mentioned, they might just be a bit odd. I'm a bit odd, so, there you go. There could be all kinds of reasons why people don't act in a certain way. your practice has got to reflect that. If you are ever going to do anything that is a bit risky or whatever that you don't want anyone to know about, then you only talk about that and do that with people who you trust 100%, you know. But everything else is, you know, you have to behave as if there is somebody there. It's just, but it doesn't, there's no percentage in going around suspecting people or being suspicious, you know. Just think, that's it, that's life. They will be there if you've got anything to say, you know, or they might not be there, you know, but it doesn't matter. I don't know if that answers your question. You've got to be philosophical about it, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, thanks.
One thing that I think it is worth talking about is, it's sort of fizzling out a bit, the discussion here. I think it might be worth thinking about, what is it we can actually do about all this? I mean, Jenny's talked about violence against women. That is a massive thing, and that is it's overwhelming when you hear all that information. You think, Jesus, you know, what do you do about that? And, you know, I look at my kids, have they grown up, and I try and bring them up in what I think is the right way, you know. But then there's other things that we're talking about, this raft of draconian laws that are coming in. How do we respond to that? The Kill the Bill protest that started up last summer, I can't remember, you know, put a lot into it, a lot of activities, a lot of action, and a lot of them burnt out. Right? I know from my own locality that a lot of the people who were up for getting out and getting onto the streets and things like that, at some point just started falling by the wayside. And now when it's come to it, you know, they're not there. You know, it's trying to get people together. So what precisely can we be doing about this? Okay, how do we deal with it? And when it does come in, how do we deal with it?
Okay, thanks, Rob.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Cheers, good. Nick. I was going to say, I think in terms of violence against women in particular, it's probably been exacerbated a bit by COVID. I work in higher education sector, and since we've started teaching in purpose again, numerous lecturers have been confronted with really quite serious incidents on campus, not just, you know, sort of bad behavior, but actually in some cases illegal activities, really threatening behavior. And of course that is sadly biased towards female lecturers and things, which get much more of it than the male lecturers. So it is a real issue, and it does seem to be exacerbated by COVID. And I don't really know what to say how we fight it, but it's just, I think, worth highlighting it, that it is something that is really needs tackling. And it's getting really, it seems to be getting worse rather than better, unfortunately.
Okay, thanks for that, Zach. Ah, Tim.
I'm involved in a local organisation called Bristol Defenders Solidarity, and we've been supporting, well, two big campaigns in the last 18 months. One of them was the Colston Four, and then we've also got the Kill the Bill Defendants. So with the Kill the Bill Defendants, what we've been trying to do is generate a kind of defendant-led campaign that's currently running under the nasty name of Bristol Anti-Repression Campaign. But this has been pretty slow work. Most of the defendants have not been conscious political activists. They are generally quite disorganized and in some ways very chaotic. And it's been a very slow process to bring them together, both for their own cases, but also to build a wider campaign against repression that would start to push back against like the general media narrative, and to go out and win friends and influence people and bring more people back onto the street. And that campaign is now, I mean, it meets every week and it's kind of on the cusp of going public, but it's taken us about 3 months to get it to that stage. Now, I know many of us here have been involved in work for, well, in some cases, probably five decades, in some cases, slightly less. Even if you've been doing it for 5 decades, I think that, I mean, it's probably even harder for you lot because like we've gone backwards, basically. But I don't think that there's any alternative to kind of long-term grassroots work, trying to get out there, get out and about, have the arguments. You don't need like a massive, sexy, violent or not demo. You need to try and engage, but it's very hard to get outside of the kind of political milieu and to take your arguments to the wider class. Because either they're not interested or they're too busy doing other stuff, sitting on social media, watching the telly, no money, no funds to go out, or they've been scared off the streets, which is kind of what we've seen in Bristol in, say, certainly in the last 6 months. But if I compare the Kill the Bill defendants campaign-related stuff to, say, the Colston case, which really couldn't get much fluffier, that was a pretty peaceful bit of direct action in the midst of a 10,000-strong demonstration, generally supported by a very large number of people in Bristol, both black and white. So even running a support campaign for those four people has also been extremely fucking hard work. You know, we've kind of like, we went from just doing a kind of very narrow defence campaign to broadening it out to try and involve people, God help us, from the Green Party and the Labour Party and various other types, and like, and playing on the fact that no one got hurt when the statue came down. And it was all very nice and peaceful, if you like. But again, people generally were not interested. Like, lots of like support on social media, but in terms of actually doing anything, it's another matter. It's like we've lost the consciousness or the remembrance that to do stuff, it's no good just sending a sodding tweet or a Facebook post. You actually have to get out there. You have to go out to where the enemy is and to where your class and expected solidarity is, and somehow try and interact with them. But it's proving very, very difficult these days. And I say that having spent the last 3 days sitting on a computer doing follow-up work to the Colston case. I haven't actually spoken to anyone in real life, and arguably I'm not doing it now. But it is, it's a real problem. It's slow. And I think today's younger generations kind of, they've become kind of humanized into expecting some very quick, instant gratification. And they've lost the understanding that this stuff takes years. You know, we're being rolled back 100 years at the moment in the course of just a few years. It's going to take us a few years to push back and change anything around. But I think, like, these are issues that we need to consider. A lot of people don't want to consider them because they're too bleeding painful to think about. But if we don't consider them, we're not going to turn it around.
Well, thanks for those cogent comments. Is Jenny next?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, absolutely. I really feel for what you just said. And I think it is a long, hard slog. And I mean, in relation to violence against women, you know, if we don't trust the police and are not prepared to go through the sort of humiliation of the judicial process and all the rest of it, the only other alternative is in building communities and building solidarity so that we look after each other. And certainly, you know, when I was raped, I mean, it was a very long time ago, it was nearly 50 years ago, you know, but it was my friends and comrades around me who ran the fella out of town, basically, and protected me. But I mean, we're not all in that position, you know. It's not easy to organise that. And I mean, that was one of the logic with the women's refuges, would be, you know, to provide a whole, you know, system of solidarity and support that would allow those women to regain their humanity and their, you know, confidence, and to be able to you know, take part in the community and survive, really. And I think one of the difficulties we're faced with at the moment is that because of the pandemic, there's just so much increased isolation, you know, it's really hard to, you know, I'm not very good at Zooming and, you know, all the other paraphernalia of computers. You know, I like to actually talk to people face to face, but it's not easy, and it's not something that, you know, falls into place very, but I suppose that is what we have to try and build.
Okay, thank you, Jenny.
Colette here. Thank you very much, Jenny, for everything you've said. It's very interesting to me because I have suffered similar to you. I won't go into the details, but I was listening online to a woman from Southall Black Sisters. And also in America, black women that didn't trust the police when they'd been raped were organised in their own sort of protection in their own community. And they did very well. And basically, they all would turn up to someone's house if they'd chucked a man out, and when he turned up and caused trouble, they'd all support her and things. And it was very good. Now, as a left-wing person in a very right-wing area, I don't know how to start putting out those organisational skills, because I work very early in the morning as a cleaner. I'm out at 4 a.m. I know there's other women out at 4 a.m. We see each other, and sometimes we frighten each other as we walk around the corners, you know, in the roads in Dover, because it's a right-wing area, you know, and we're just working class women at the end of the day. And there's always creeps about. How, and I've often thought to myself, because I'm cleaning for the NHS and so are other women, should we speak to each other? Should we say we're frightened? Because we all know that we are. And should we try and organise? But how? You know, what do we do to look out for each other? Now, I waved at a woman once who was looking out of a window while she was mopping the floor. And I thought, well, that's connection. And I waved because we sort of know each other. But I would like a bit more, you know, like, how do you organise protection for yourselves? And I witnessed women being harassed. I was in Folkestone the other day with my granddaughter, and I worry for her because a woman was, there was a group of three males, and they were going, at this woman. And she said, right, that's the third time you've done that to me now this week. Okay. And they sort of shut up. But I thought, really, I should have felt able to go on over to her and said, yeah, I witnessed that as well. But I don't really like dealing with police. They're not a lot of use. How? How do we protect ourselves? But perhaps I should have gone over to her and said, I witnessed that. That was awful, you know. And I didn't. And I feel quite cross with myself for not doing that. But, yeah, it's all just a case of how and where do we start?
Thank you, Colette.
Yeah, it's all, I mean, the comments that people said, it is difficult. Partly it's difficult is because this is the society that's been created intentionally. The concept of community and people looking out for each other and backing each other up has been ground down it's always been ground. I'm not looking back to an idyllic past or anything where everything was wonderful, because it never was. But this sort of idea of connection has been ground down, and that does make it very difficult. You know, people are sitting on social media and they might connect with a like or something, but actual talking to someone face to face is a difficult thing. Breaking all that down is all part of breaking down any spirit of resistance, communication and connections between ordinary people. And that's, I think, as Tim said earlier, it's a long road. We've got to start building this stuff now, and making those connections is a hard slog. I think it's a great idea to you know, these people who you pass every day, and to actually wave at them and things like that and say hello, maybe eventually have a conversation with them, you know. But that's how things move on. That's how we make these connections, you know, and it's hard. It's not easy to do that. But it's rebuilding. Community's been smashed. Okay, whatever that community was, there's never been any sort of real community, because a real community is where there's some concept of solidarity, and in revolutionary terms, a concept of resistance as well. So we need to be helping to create the conditions for that. It always makes me smile when people talk about, oh, anarchists and things like that, or communists or whoever it is, and we're going to start a revolution. No, you're fucking not. The people who are going to start a revolution, the people out there, right? The people who are not necessarily part of your political group or your political scene. It's the working class that does that revolution. And we have to keep talking to people. We have to talk to people who we won't necessarily agree with, you know, and we might say, you've got right-wing views. Educate them. You know, we try and educate them with not to have right-wing views and things like that. Yeah, I know it's easier said than done. Yeah, of course it is. It's how we do it, how we go about it, I suppose. And it's not an easy road, but we have to start building things now in our own communities, whether it's whatever the nature of it. It might only be one or two people that you make a connection with. It's something, it's a start.
But also, I was just going to I was just going to wanted to respond to what Ben's first point, just by pointing out that someone posted in the chat about a sort of guide about how to spot a spy cop. And I think it was by the Undercover Research Group. Yeah. And that's all I wanted to say, basically.
Right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the sort of, well, making connections, plus the thing about, for example, violence against women. It seems to me that in some ways we expect to, so we had mutual aid people during the beginning of COVID sprang up and people got going on it. They've all kind of disappeared, but for a while, well, I don't want to say they all have, but they mostly seem to have, but for a while they seem to actually have some impact. And it seemed to be a case of people coming together around something that actually did involve their interests. But it seems to me that the way to reach people is to be organised around shared interests and have those conversations inside those shared interests rather than going to them with a riff and expecting them to think, oh, well, that's cool, I'm with you on that, because most of the time they probably won't. Whereas my own experience is that often people who think you're a kind of left-wing arsehole, once you've worked with them, for example, in my case, in the Tenants Association, once you've worked with them hard about a particular rent campaign in this case, they begin to think, oh, well, this guy's not a complete nutter. He's actually got something that's worth listening to here.
Thank you, Paul. Jenny?
I mean, two things which, I mean, they're both from a very long time ago, but, you know, they're possible examples of how things, I mean, with the Claimants Union, like Rob, I was involved in that hundreds of years ago. And with the spies that used to come around trying to see if people were cohabiting and that sort of thing, we used to, if they came, we used to get several of us women get in the house. They were particularly after single mothers at the time. And we'd ring the police and say there was some bloke outside being harassing us sexually and you know, we were a bit frightened. And the police used to come and clear them away, which was quite effective, but it did involve getting the police to do it. And the other thing, I mean, there was a long time ago, a friend of mine was very badly beaten up by a boyfriend who, I mean, put her in hospital. She was in a dreadful state. And and she didn't want anything done about it because she was loved him still and all that. A few of us ran a post, he was at college, at university, and we ran a poster campaign and put posters up all over the university outlining what he'd done and who he was. And that caused quite a furor, and we were severely criticised by the SWP and others because we were picking on him and he was a comrade. But it did bring it out in the open, and I think, you know, publicly shaming people sometimes in relation to violence against women is not a bad thing to do. Doesn't hurt, although it might seem like, you know, picking on people personally. But then, if they did it, they did it. You know.
Thanks for that, Jenny. Kit next.
It's been a really interesting meeting. I just wanted to come back to what Colette was saying earlier. And I don't think I'm going to surprise anyone with this, but Colette was saying that she has to travel to work really unsafe times, places where she doesn't feel comfortable, and she knows that there's other workers. And I think she said she works as a cleaner in a hospital, and then that basically women workers, because of their conditions of work, are being put in positions where they feel unsafe. And, you know, I think we all heard, you know, Colette saying, well, what's the best way to tackle it? And I'm sure, you know, I'm not saying anything new here, anything surprising, but where you're in a position in a workplace where you've got a whole number of women who are being put in that same position where they feel threatened or feel uncomfortable, then I'm sure, Colette, that it might be a good idea to actually work with your fellow workers in the workplace to actually begin to group together, begin to see the way forward, begin to organise, whether it's pressure on your management to actually provide decent transport in and out of work, or whether it's organising yourselves to work out how you can support each other both in the workplace and while you're travelling to there. So I'm sure I'm not saying anything new, Colette, but it just seemed a shame that, you know, when you outlined the precise circumstances that you're being confronted with, it just seemed worth saying something and saying, do poke around in the workplace and see how you can organise with your fellow women workers around the issue. That's all I wanted to say. It has been a really excellent meeting. Thanks.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Thanks. I think we can wind up the meeting now. As I said on the chat, there'll be future ACG meetings. We hope to have them on a regular basis. We've also got a reading group, and it's starting up in February. So watch out on the ACG website for details of that. Read our publications. You produced a large number of pamphlets over the last couple of years, which you can access and have a look at on our website. So thanks, everyone. I felt it was a very useful meeting, and there's some good contributions from everyone. All right. Okay. So thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.